Hi, I'm Nancy Clare. Welcome to episode 149 of Speaking of Mysteries. In his latest novel, The Middleman, published in mid-August, Olin Steinhauer switches up locations from Europe, the site of most of his novels and his TV series Berlin Station, to the U.S. And not just the glam parts of the country. The action, an investigation by the FBI of a subversive group called Massive Brigade, moves from New York City and its suburbs to Idaho, Missouri, and Kansas. Here's Olin Steinhauer to talk about The Middleman. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and I am so excited to be talking to Olin Steinhauer about his just-released book, The Middleman. Welcome, Olin.
Thanks for having me, Nancy.
You know, I'd like to start talking about The Middleman at the end of your book with the acknowledgments. You write that this book took 5 years from idea to final draft, and that means you probably started it 7 years ago. And that seems amazing to anyone who's read it, because it really is a ripped-from-the-headlines story. So even back at the beginning of this decade, were you picking up something in the ether about not trusting our institutions?
Well, I think really the genesis of it, I mean, I say 5 years, but it probably went back a lot further when I was a young man in Austin, Texas. And I started hanging out with friends who had sort of more, you know, more radical political persuasions. And I had a good friend who was, you know, a self-described Marxist who taught me a fair amount about Marxism that I didn't know anything about. And one thing he was always interested in was the convergence of politics and art. And there's a wonderful book called Lipstick Traces by Greil Marcus. I think it's subtitled The Secret History of the 20th Century. It came out in the 90s. And it follows the rise of sort of politically motivated art after World War I, Dadaism and Surrealism, et cetera, through Situationism, and parallels it with the rise of punk music. And all this sounds like it's sort of like a salad of thoughts. And I had always wanted to write a book sort of about a radical underground, and very much inspired by, you know, movements of the 60s and 70s that I had always been sort of fascinated by. And I had never found a way to get into that. So during most of my career, I was living in Europe. And then I come back home to America, and I started picking up on sort of the high level of cynicism about politics in the country, which after spending a decade away, I was sort of forgot about or maybe wasn't even fully familiar with. And that always struck me as that then struck me as, oh, okay, maybe now I can enter into this subject. And when I say it took 5 years to write, I was originally writing it, you know, during the Obama years. And I had to, once the 2016 election happened, I realized I had to sort of change gears on the novel. And the reason for that is in the original draft that I turned into my editor, Kelly, the Massive Brigade was sort of a different beast than it is now. It was much more violent. It was sort of a Dadaist experiment that was influenced by these old schools of art that I was just talking about. But they were also, and they were vicious. They were much more vicious. Murder was casually used. And as someone who actually has some sort of sympathies for sort of radical movements, at least up the left, I realized after the election that this story could be used by, in a way, my political antagonists as a tool. to show, oh, look how violent the left is. When in fact, that doesn't, to my mind, that doesn't really reflect reality. I see more violence on the right. And so sort of for the first time in my life, I'd written a novel where at the end of it, I had these moral qualms about what I had written, who could use it for good or ill. And it made me sort of sit down and start again. Not entirely. It was always, in general, the same story. But the nuances of it really had to change for me to feel comfortable putting it out in the world, which I found fascinating because I had literally never felt that before. But this is also the first book I've written focused entirely on America and American politics. Everything else deals with sort of the inside baseball of either Cold War or present day espionage. So it's a different beast entirely for me.
You anticipated one of the follow-up questions I had, which was, you know, the influence of the election in 2016. And I felt that moral sort of indecision. I didn't look at it as qualms in your book. This struck me as a little bit of dangerous, and we'll talk about that maybe, because this is a story that I found had equal opportunity duplicity, and both sides are using tools that range from misdirection to murder to get what they want, and everyone lies. A couple of people saw me reading The Middleman and asked what it was about, and I didn't want to drop any spoilers, and it's really hard to talk about this book without doing that. So because I live in LA, I created sort of this pitch description that the plot is a little like the Occupy movement meets the Leftovers.
That's a great description. I like that. I'm going to start using that.
Please, gift to you. And that government agencies, United States government agencies, are scrambling to leverage Massive Brigade, as the organization is called. So can you talk a little bit about that? I'm glad I'm not totally off base with my description. To talk a little bit about Massive Brigade and the duplicitous nature of both sides of the equation and how you approach that as a writer.
Right. Maybe to take a slight step back. The impulse to write the book, it had its history that I was talking about. But really, it's about political frustration. So if you are a citizen in a country and you feel like your vote doesn't matter, and which is essentially the only power you have, what's the next step? You go out, maybe you demonstrate, and then, hey, look, nothing really changes. This level of frustration that can lead someone to violence was always my interest there. I'm always fascinated by what makes essentially decent people do bad things. And also, as I was writing this, though my sympathies are with the Massive Brigade, I always have a horror of writing something that's propaganda. So it even at the very beginning, you have this sort of party going on in New Jersey with these kind of self-consciously liberal people, of which I am one. And essentially, I was populating it with my peer group. And hopefully, it comes through that I'm making fun of them throughout it. It's a lot of easy answers to very difficult questions are sort of popped out, which is why one of the characters who's at that party, who is part of this peer group, becomes radicalized in the space of like 24 hours. So in terms of the Massive Brigade, it started off purely as a leftist group in my original drafts. And what I tried to do was to open it up politically to kind of instead of making a partisan argument of some kind, they were trying to make the meta argument of the elite are happy for us to be at each other's necks because they're the ones who make all the money off of us. And someone says at some point, like, what would it, if you were in a basement dog fight, you had a basement dog fight, two pit bulls going at each other, you know, what would happen if suddenly the pit bull's eyes were opened to what's really going on, to who their real enemy was? Then it would be a bloodbath. And part of Massive Brigade's project is to try to, you know, to help people see sort of more clearly what the meta issues are so that they will push against those in elected power. As Martin Bishop says, politicians don't do anything unless they have fear. And it's either fear of the ballot box, or if they're not afraid of that because they gerrymandered their districts, you know, insanely, then have them fear for their lives, because fear is the only thing that will push politics to a better level. And it's an argument. It's not, you know, I don't necessarily agree with it all the time, but, you know, it has some logic to it.
And we can see it demonstrated from time to time.
Exactly.
You know, I did not see this book as a polemic, and that was what was so really fascinating about it. There's no one walks away unscathed. There's no, there are no heroes in this book.
This is one of the, I mean, it's, I don't know if it's a good thing, but it's something that is very common in my books. No one, I mean, I sometimes play the shades of gray to its absolute limit. And my wife sometimes says to me, you know, can you just write a heroic character? You know, maybe you'd sell more. But it's how it's, you know, every writer writes in the way that they see the world. And mine may seem bleak in some ways, but I also don't expect huge things of my neighbors as a result. I'm often pleasantly surprised by people I run into each day because I don't expect much of them. And so in a way, I don't expect so much of my characters. In my books, an organization like the CIA or KGB in my older books, they're less monolithic entities than they are collections of flawed human beings. So my stories will often be about the flaws that these individuals have. And I don't know that I could have written The Massive Brigade much differently than I did, to show how there is infighting, but that infighting is not the result always of, you know, ideological opinions, but often it's the result of insecurities, fears, or prejudices that everybody has.
So you sort of follow the John le Carré school of writing about intelligence agencies and the sort of the humanness of the characters. And the closest character you have, I think, to a hero is Rachel, the FBI agent. And, you know, that she's fascinating. She really is fascinating because it looks like she wants to go after the truth. And she does. But the truth is a little bit fungible, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, Rachel, you know, I needed that sort of steadfast, investigative character to carry us through. And I'm quite pleased with how she turned out. But even she has her moments where you're not quite sure. And hopefully, at the end, the very end, the final scene with her, I'm trying to suggest that even she is not as clean as we would hope.
She's not immune to temptation.
No, she's not. And she's, you know, not to give away too much, but But she will appear in the next book too.
Oh, good.
I want to follow through a little bit to see where she ended up. I'm not quite sure of how vast of a role she's going to have, but I quite like her, and I certainly want to see more of her.
It's always nice to see a woman that is not, a lot of times women characters seem to be, and maybe I'm sensitive to this because I am a woman, that, you know, they're either noble or, you know, that although Rachel is, I think her moral compass is in pretty good shape for one of your characters. Yeah. She's complicated, and that's one of the things that's so appealing about your books, about Myla Weaver, about your stories, and why it's so great to talk to you about more or less a standalone. And Rachel is pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, this book was really, it was written to be a standalone, and then about, you know, halfway through those 5 years, I thought, oh, actually, I think I know how to continue, not necessarily this story. It's probably best to describe it as a standalone, because essentially this novel is one aspect of what should become like a meta story over the next book or two. So it is best to think of it as a standalone. It's sort of all new characters.
And it's very much a book of this decade of the 21st century, though. You know, social media is fanning the fires of paranoia against Massive Brigade, and the constituents, you mentioned this in the book, the constituents begin to contact their representatives demanding that Massive Brigade be shut down. And if I didn't already have an uneasy feeling about this book and about social media, I would after reading your book. I mean, I like many people of my age, and I'm actually old enough to remember the movements of the 60s and 70s. And I keep thinking, you know what it made me think about? I was at University of California, Santa Barbara in 1970 for the burning of the bank and the demonstrations. Mm-hmm. But interestingly, and something that is sort of lost, and you've used the word meta in this meta story of students uprising between January and May, which was Kent State, was the firing of a professor named Bill Allen. And I can't remember, he wasn't fired, but he was denied tenure, and then his contract was canceled. And he had been a professor that was sympathetic, and I can't remember, he was either anthropology or sociology, one of the ologies, not something I was taking. I was a chemistry major. But this sort of trigger and the way things, the information disseminated, and how both similar and different that was to the social media, the way both sides of the equation used it. So did it creep you out to write it as much as it did to read it?
I suppose there were moments, you know, you spread it out over 5 years, so it's a little more bearable. You can sort of take it. But there were moments where I thought, okay, well, maybe this is too ridiculous, particularly first draft stuff. But history has shown me that not much is too ridiculous to be believable. Like I said, my biggest concern was to not come up with, you know, some polemical exercise, because there was going to be plenty of that. There have been plenty of moments just looking at the news that have creeped me out completely, that in a way the book is probably tame in comparison. You know, I have, when you were talking about constituents calling up their representatives to ask for the Massive Brigade to be shut down, most of that is triggered by cable news fanning the flames in order to get ratings. And then it becomes this larger issue of, okay, they're fanning the flames because of capitalism. They want advertisers, they want viewers. But then that desire for money ends up having a real-world effect. ends up getting people upset with the massive brigade and wanting to shut it down at a point that the massive brigade has shown no violent tendencies at all. And I don't know. I don't think I have a clear cut answer for the creep out question. But I sort of wander
creep
around.
Out in a good way, in a good way.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
The other thing, and this is more subtle, and you have to understand, I worked for a newspaper, I've worked for publications throughout my career, and most recently for the Los Angeles Times. So this is a little bit more on the subtle side, is the relationship between law enforcement and the media. And the Los Angeles Times, before it moved, was actually across the street from the new LAPD headquarters, and they used the LA Times cafeteria. They didn't have their own cafeteria.
Wow.
So, yeah. So, and this is something that I know goes on, and I thought it was really interesting that Rachel, who's the chief FBI agent looking into Massive Brigade, is also the chief source for a far-right commentator, and this is with the full knowledge. The FBI is feeding what they want to feed, and I wonder... It's something you obviously know, and I don't think it's something that the news-consuming public on both sides of the spectrum realize, is all of these sources, and I'm using air quotes, although I detest them, are frequently, it's all part of the dance. This is all like a dance, and I thought the way you did it was so... accurate.
Thank you. I mean, it's these days, you know, so much, there's so much talk of anonymous sources. Oh, anonymous sources in the White House, etc. And it's clear that the sort of relationship, I'm forgetting the word, it's everyone's feeding off of each other.
Symbiotic.
Symbiotic, that is the word. Thank you. And yeah, I mean, it seems it's so blatant these days. And this is, I think the fact that it's known that, at least that it's done through the White House, through Congress, this relationship with the media, I wonder, though, if this is leading to people's distrust. I know the president fans the flames of that, saying, you know, condemning the use of anonymous sources, when in fact there's always been anonymous sources. Nothing has changed about that. But people are so... the thing that creeped me out as I was writing the book, and this wasn't necessarily from the book itself, but observation of the world, is the lack of respect for objective truth, or the lack of recognition that objective truth exists. This is something that's been, you know, really since the campaign has been intensifying. And I'm sure it was sort of an underground feeling before that point, partly fanned by Fox News, I believe. But this idea that no one can agree on basic objective facts, that gives me, that's like gut-wrenching to me. That's the most troubling thing in the last few years that's happened to this country. I mean, there have been horrible things that have happened, but to me, that's the thing that's going to have at least a semi-permanent effect on our country. And also on Europe. Look, they're playing the same game there. They you know, each country sees that it works in somewhere else, and so they try it as well.
I want to switch gears a little bit away from the middleman to my other wonderful thing that you've done, which is Berlin Station. You explore similar themes of leveraging protest groups and sort of the give and take between the intelligence and law enforcement agencies and the media, and you do this in Berlin Station, and please tell me there's going to be a season 3. I need Hector DeGene.
Well, it is shooting now, so that's the good news. There is a season 3. My relationship to it was creator, and for the first season, I was there in the writer's room on set and everything, which was an amazing experience. We were there in Berlin the whole time. Season 2, I was working on The Middleman, because I had a deadline. I was a few years behind on, which is one reason in the afterword you find me thanking my patient editor for you know, not freaking out. And now it's season three. But I wasn't, even though I'm not there, I still approve scripts and I get the conversations with whoever is show running. And that was very interesting in season two, the use of the rise of the far right. And it's funny, you talk about these things that when you're in Europe, you can see them plainly around you. And then the season comes out and people are like, oh my God, you're so prescient. Well, no, not really. It was just going on. It was going on there already. And it was a good story. But yeah, this is making a TV show. That was, it's just an incredible amount of luck I had. Because the story of how I ended up coming up with it was a simple thing. My wife and I had moved, and daughter had moved from Budapest to New York because we just wanted to resettle and try everything. But on the way, we had friends in Berlin, and we stayed. It was just like a week with them, and we loved the city so much. It's such a livable city, and then we arrive in Manhattan. And Manhattan was one of those particularly noisy, hot days where it stank and there was horns going and you couldn't see the sky because of the tall buildings and everything was under construction. And my wife turns to me and says, can you find a way for us to live in Berlin for half the year? And so 2 months later, I thought, hey, that would be a good way. And so I came up with the idea for the show. And remarkably, I mean, I'm already a published novelist, so that sort of helped some, but the series of decisions that ended up allowing me to make a TV show, you know, with like a solid budget on a solid TV network, Epics, is just sort of phenomenal. And the experience was rather incredible. I learned so much about it. And there will be more film, TV stuff in the future.
It's a fascinating show, and in off the cuff conversations with that one or two people that I've known that have worked for the intelligence agencies, they all talk about your show and how accurate it is. So
no, really?
Yes.
That is so nice to hear. I mean, we were working with a consultant to make sure a lot of the details were right. But I've been reviewed, and Berlin Station was also reviewed in the CIA's...
their internal thing, yeah.
Studies in intelligence, you know, and the part of it that's not declassified, where they review pop culture things. And they annihilate everything they review. I think they were particularly upset that we had some CIA characters doing some bad things. But it's also a TV show. But my interest in writing the books and also in writing the series, what interests me is not really the technical, how do spies get this or that done? I mean, obviously you want to get it right, but that's not the thing that drives me. To me, writing about spies is about writing about the psychological toll that living with some level of duplicity, you know, puts on you. And you have people who do their job for sometimes the best of reasons, usually for the best of reasons, sometimes for the worst of reasons. And, you know, like anyone, they have their flaws. And their job is to bend the truth or simply break the truth in service to a larger thing, which is the security of the United States, which is something I have complete respect for. But I also know that puts you in a moral quandary. And I'm interested in what that does to people. How long can you take dealing in falsehoods before it starts to mess with your own mind? Do you know what's true anymore? Does it matter what's true anymore? Which, of course, brings back to the thing that's horrified me over these last years is the lack of objective truth in the world. But that's always the thing that fascinated me. And the reason why, you know, you bring up John le Carré, and he's the reason why I write spy fiction. I was only mildly interested in it before reading reading The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, and then after that, Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy, which I've reread, you know, I don't know how many times, because it was about the human repercussions on these people, but also there was a scope to the subject matter the spy novels deal with. You can write a great social novel, which I consider Tinker Tailor to be one of the great social novels of the 20th century. You know, it describes Britain at a point in time with such specificity and such sort of beauty in a way that was, for me, that was like a breath of fresh air to see that a genre could open itself up and do everything, which is why I continue on that path right now.
And it's a whole other discussion, the idea of that fiction is broken into genre, because your books aside, which are, you know, the idea of a literary thriller or a literary, and this is, don't let me get on this hobby horse, without mentioning your novels, which are as literary as any novels, only they have plot and character. To bring up Le Carré, who is, you know, so eloquent and amazing and illuminating, and how can that not? How can Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy, or The Tailor of Panama, or any of his books, not be considered literature, because they're about people in situations, and that's what literature should be. So
exactly. Yeah. No, I know. That is a whole nother conversation right there. Yeah. I think part of the reason why I was so blown away by Le Carré is because I had just come out of grad school, or I was just about to leave grad school, and I had been sort of trained or brainwashed into making those divisions, and I sort of bought into it because everybody else was smarter than me, and I thought I might as well listen to them. And it wasn't until I was on my way out that I cracked this open. Actually, you know what actually started it was Raymond Chandler. It was Raymond Chandler, then John le Carré, and I was like, whoa, nobody told me about this. So I came to it later than I should have.
But maybe you came to it at the right time.
True.
Thank you so much, Owen, for talking to us about all of this, and for reinforcing our shared love of Carré and Raymond Chandler.
Mm-hmm. And thank you, Nancy.
I look forward to the next book.
All right. Oh, I'm working hard on it.